accession number 28361, reel 42.
General Julian Thompson, reel 42. You were saying that you and Southby Taylor turned up with maps, with charts and notebooks.
Yes. The charts of the Falklands were the original surveys were done in the 1890s and hadn't been updated very much since then. And for example, I've got a copy of his, which eventually was published as a book, and this is an example of the sort of detailed work he'd done on just San Carlos water.
Plotting depths,
where there was kelp, and he told us that kelp actually is an aid to navigation and nothing to be worried about. And plotting beach gradients, which of course is absolutely vital when it comes to carrying out an amphibious operation. So he said, and he was also an expert on the flora and fauna of the islands, and I said, I'll have those charts and notebooks, and he clutched them under his arm and said, they only come if I come with them. So though it was not within my place to say so, he wasn't under my command, he belonged to another command. I said, right, you're coming.
I was going to ask you how you managed to get him posted or annexed to your headquarters, because presumably he the military secretary would be involved in ratifying his appointment.
I did it by that was another advantage about being alongside my superior quarters. I went to see the Colonel AQ, and who I knew and was a friend of mine. I said, I want Southby Terry. He said, well, I'll fix it. So I didn't have to bother him, but he just did it. And I did exactly the same with other people. Like, I decided I needed a deputy brigade commander, which I didn't have on establishment. And the reason I wanted that was that I was going to have three, the original reason for it was that I was going to have three commandos or battalions, all commanded by strong characters, all sitting in one liner. And I could foresee clashes of personalities, you know, arguing about training areas and things like that. And I needed someone to slap their wrists and arbitrate. And also to deal with the very senior Royal Navy captain who had been sent to this ship as the Royal Naval Liaison Officer. I didn't want him chucking his weight around. So I got hold of a chap who was a great personal friend of mine called Colonel Seckham, who was a full colonel, very experienced chap. And I had him sent to Canberra, originally a sort of OC troops, but I then made him my deputy brigade commander. So there was a huge amount of willingness to let people go. Another example, the chap I wanted to take to run my PR was away skiing or someone, and he'd been the chap I would normally have been allocated, and I managed to get one out of another headquarters, and I was very lucky because I got a chap called David Nichols, who was an Everest mountaineer, again had been decorated for gallantry in the Dofar, and therefore had enormous street cred with the press when it came to talking about military matters. And so he was sent to me. There was a great deal of willingness to make things work and within the Royal Marines, and not saying, well, he's not in your formation, so you can't have him.
Where's Colonel Seckham from? Was he a Marine?
He was a Royal Marine, yes. And I can't remember what he was doing at the time. I think he might have been, luckily, sort of in between jobs or doing the job which could be dispensed with for a short time.
And his role then was to be primus inter pares with your...
His job was to be in, originally, the idea that I had for him was to be in charge of Canberra and be able there to decide on priorities. I mean, if you had just three COs fighting it out between them on board the ship, I mean, they might come to some sort of agreement. Then there were a whole lot of other subunits as well, and you needed someone to be in charge of what was over 2,000 chaps. And he was just the sort of chap to do it. He was a sort of an avuncular figure with great experience. He wasn't going to chuck his weight around, but anyone who stepped out of line was going to get slapped on the wrist. And then he would do things like divvy up all the facilities on board the ship, and make certain that every battalion had its own rec space. Every battalion had a training area. He would run a training conference, so he'd allocate... The most popular bit of the ship was the boat deck, because if you ran around the boat deck once, you'd run a quarter of a mile. So that was in demand from dawn till dusk, and therefore had to be allocated. There had to be a proper setup on board to ensure that all the facilities were fairly distributed.
You had your own formal, shall we call it a briefing? Conference.
Briefing.
Yeah. And you said no questions arose from that. What about the parallel session going on next door? Did that go smoothly?
As far as I know, I mean, I wasn't involved in it. Well,
presumably, you heard about it.
I heard. I said, "Any problems?" They said, "No, and that was it." I didn't ask anymore. That was it. At the same time, incidentally, another unit that came to me was the SAS.
Yes.
Mike Rose rang me up and said, "Do you want us to come and join?" I said, "Yes, please." "What can you bring with you?" And he said, "Two squadrons." I mean, you know, it was just done on that sort of basis.
So he rang up personally.
He rang me up and said, "Do you want me?"
Yes. He was then commanding.
He was then commanding 22.
Commanding the regiment.
Yeah.
Okay.
He said, "Do you want me?" So I said, "Yes." I was also allocated the whole of the SBS bar of one section, which I didn't normally have under command at all.
What was the strength of the SBS at that time?
In those days, they were organised into what they call sections, which was very confusing, but are now called squadrons. And they were very much smaller than the sabre squadrons of the SAS in those days. And I suppose the sections that I had, each section was about 20 men plus one or two other people. I mean, it wasn't a large organisation. I can't remember exactly what the size of them was.
What sort of equipment did they have? What craft were they?
Well, they had canoes and they had Geminis and all the sort of things you would expect. Mm. They were badly equipped, actually, from a communication point of view.
Wirelesses and so on.
Yes. Though on the market you could buy a little box, which was about that size, about the size of a cigar box.
Yes.
Into which you could punch a coded message. Mm. And it would come up on a thing that looked like a till receipt on a till, and you could then press a button and you would send it burst transmit through your HF radio. Yeah. They didn't have that. Though it was available. They weren't allowed to buy it. They said, "Can we buy it?" And they said, they were told, "No, can't afford it."
Was it commercially produced?
It was commercially produced.
Mm. Presumably, it was used for business purposes.
I imagine it was. I mean, and later, I can tell you, you know, a couple of years later, we bought it for the SBS. But so their communications normally was on HF. And as you know, HF is sort of funny about the distances over which it will communicate. Mm. And the most efficient way of communicating with HF, as far as the SBS was concerned, was communicating to a base station, which you wanted to be probably about 800 or 900 miles away minimum, because that was the
bounce it off exactly.
Mm. And so the plot, which eventually emerged, was that when they were on the ground in the Falklands, they communicated back to Ascension, 4,000 miles away, HF, and then at Ascension the message was broadcast on a secure voice or secure means, not voice, teleprinter to me. But their HF was not burst transmission. And in order to encode the signals, you had to send them on a one-time pad by Morse. So if you were sending a long thing like a beach report, it would probably take you an hour and a half to tap it out, by which time, after about 10 minutes, the Argentines would be knocking on your door. So, I can come on to that later, but that's the sort of restrictions they had on their equipment. It was pretty archaic, and it was all part of the business of not enough attention and money and resources being given to amphibious operations.
What was their normal role? Was it covert surveillance of landing sites?
Well, the roles of the SBS were a number. For an amphibious operation, their role was beach recce and surveillance of landing sites by helicopter and or over a beach. Beach recce was very important because they would establish what was known as the beach gradient, which is absolutely critical if you're going to put landing craft onto it. And that was done, and I think it's still done that way. I was asking an SBS guy the other day. I think it may have been just superseded by some higher technology, but the way it was done in 1982 was no different from the way it was done in 1942, which was by putting a stake in the beach at the high water marks. You did it at high tide at night, and you then swam out to sea on a bearing. You had a compass. And you dropped a plumb line at intervals along the line you were going out. And you knew how far you were because you had knots in the line as you swam out. And you wrote on your knee were using a waterproof pencil or a waterproof pad, the depth of water. Mm. And what that gave you on a particular bearing was the depth of the water as you swam out to sea, and it gave you the beach gradient.
Sounds like a very enterprising use of string technology.
Very, very. Anything to say about it, it was pretty simple.
Well, it worked for D-Day.
It worked for us.
Yeah. It is obviously very hazardous.
Yes.
And subject to human error. But
exactly. It's hazardous, you may get caught.
Yes.
And it's subject to human error, of course.
What about sampling the actual material of the beach?
Well, they could do that. They were trained to do that, but we didn't do that for the Falkland Islands.
You didn't do the bucket and spade.
We didn't do the bucket and spade, mainly because Ewan was able to tell us what the beach, because he had in his, he'd had a shale or rock or whatever.
He'd done it already.
Mm. And in fact, one of the beaches we couldn't survey, and his information on it wasn't very precise because he hadn't got round to that bit, and in thereby hangs a tail, and that screwed up three para slightly, as we'll come to later. The reason they couldn't do the survey was because the beach was right by a village which was occupied by half an Argentine company, so they couldn't be splashing about in the water doing that. They could merely observe the beach from an OP. But I'm jumping ahead of the story here. You were asking what else they were trained to do. The other things they were trained to do, which did not affect this operation, was maritime counter-terrorism, which I can come on to when I talk about my next job. And the other thing they were trained to do, of course, was ship attack, which again was not relevant in this sense. But one thing they were trained to do, which would have been relevant here, was exiting from submarines while submerged. Now, the advantage of that is, instead of flying a noisy helicopter into a landing site, which has to then, by definition, be at least a day, preferably 3 days or nights march away from the objective, so you don't give away what you're interested in, is you can exit from a submarine while it's dived, and therefore invisible, swim into a beach, taking your kit with you, which gives you a very clandestine insertion means. And of course you can be extracted that way too.
Using frogman gear.
Well, using frogman gear, and they're trained to exit from a dived submarine and go back into a dived submarine. Now, we asked for, very early on, a diesel-electric submarine for this very purpose, because at that stage, it would be impractical to use an SSN because they're so big. I mean, SSN's the size of a Type 42 frigate. You can't get close enough to make it a swimmable distance. Mm. But to begin with, again, part of this unreality syndrome in Sink Fleet, we were told we couldn't have a diesel-electric submarine. Eventually it appeared, but almost towards the end of the war.
Had anyone ever thought of developing underwater vehicles?
Oh, yes.
Thought the Italians used.
There were a number of swimmer delivery vehicles, is the OK phrase, SDVs, on the market, and the SBS had played with them. But again, we're talking about money. I mean, in the same ways, we didn't have a hovercraft. All these toys had been played with, and everyone said, "Let's have them." But when it came to saying, "Can we buy them?" Yet, you can't have them. And in fact, afterwards, and I can come on to this later when I talk about my next job, we had swimmer delivery vehicles, and they now have them. Mm. So you can have a garage built on back of one of the submarines to take them. Mm. But I mean, this is all in the future.
Yeah.
I think it's all part of this mindset that amphibious operations are a complete waste of time. We'll never do one again. The quicker we can get rid of the Royal Marines and all that stuff, the better.
Going back to the question of beaches, of course, I think one of the greatest hazards to beach landing is mud. Consideration around
mud? Mud can be a hazard, as they discovered at Maibon and also in Operation Zipper in Malaya. That wasn't really considered because there's no mud behind Falkland beaches, the ones you're going to use. Mm. And that I was aware of, what there was behind, of course, was peat.
Yeah.
Which meant the exits. There were no wheeled vehicle exits, and you couldn't drive a wheeled vehicle off the beach.
Mm.
So there's no point in driving it off the beach anyway, because you couldn't drive it anywhere, so you didn't take them, or you only took a few. The two biggest threats for an amphibious operation are surf, which means you can't use the beach in bad weather, because all your craft will broach. And the second one is where you have what's known as a runnel, which is when the beach gradient goes down like that very nicely, and then there's a lump in the middle, and then it goes down again. So your craft,
sandbars,
and your craft then beach, well short of the beach, and then there's a sort of way to the height of this room beyond the sandbar, so there's no way you can get anything ashore, and you're stranded off there, but completely helpless. Or the craft hits it, and this has happened to me, at night, and you think you're on the beach, you all leap out, and as the guys leap out, the craft becomes lighter, so it manages to ride over the runnels and goes over you as you're trying to wade in. So the beach gradient is critical, actually, and of course the beach exits are critical, and that's something else the SBS were trained to do recces on and produce a report on.
Presumably, I mean, had you and Salter Taylor done that, or was he just interested in the immediate area of the beach?
Well,
he and the offshore and the foreshore.
He was interested in he was interested in the approaches to the beaches and the beach exits.
Oh, he was,
but not in any great detail the beach exits,
no.
Because you know he was producing a coastal pilot, but he knew, having been there, where you could drive off the beach and where you couldn't, in round terms.
But when you'd had your initial informal briefing sessions with your commanding officers, what was your next task as you saw it? You'd let them know that they're off on an adventure somewhere in the South Atlantic. You didn't know what you were going to be doing, weren't sure about the operational plan or details, but they were to get themselves ready to go south on ship and to train as much as they could on the way.
Yeah.
What happened next?
Well, the other thing I should have mentioned is that my staff had managed to produce for this, the shipping conference, as we called it, which was the other meeting, the tables. They produced the staff tables within 48 hours, less than 48 hours, which is a pretty good effort, in my opinion. Yeah. Now, what happened after that was by now I'd been joined by Commodore Clapp, who was the commanding the amphibious ships. His title at the time was Commodore Amphibious Warfare. In modern terminology, he's Com-A Tag, the Commodore Amphibious Task Group, and he didn't call him that in those days. That's what he did. And we decided that we jointly would go to Northwood to find out what the hell was going on, you know, to try and get some info out of them, which was in pretty short supply. So we were very lucky because the helicopters based at Yeovilton, the naval Lynxes, which were fitted with radars, which was useful because it meant they were not weather dependent. They could fly, whatever, if it was pissing with rain, they could still fly us and land us somewhere, were placed at our disposal as a taxi service.
That was your liaison then?
Well, no, he was just a helicopter pilot. I mean,
he was providing a liaison flight.
Well, he was providing a liaison service, flight, which was very useful. So instead of having to flog all the way to Northwood by car, after this meeting, we jumped into this helicopter and flew up to Northwood. We then followed a sort of opera bouffe thing, because he couldn't find the pilot on his pad, the landing site designated for this major NATO headquarters. For some reason, perhaps they hadn't promulgated it, I don't know. So we flew around trying to find somewhere to land. And the place that he selected to land, to begin with, was a sort of playground right next to all the quarters. So as we descended through in clouds of dust, there were furious housewives rescuing their washing, holding down their skirts, and shaking their fists at this helicopter all simultaneously, surrounded by screaming children. I mean, I couldn't hear them screaming. So I said, I don't think this is a very good place to land. So we eventually found a rugger pitch and landed on that, which turned out to be the designated LS. And we were met and driven to this headquarters, which is in a sort of hole in the ground in Northwood.
I was going to ask you what it's like actually in the headquarters at Northwood.
It's a sort of Führer bunker, I suppose is the best way to describe it. And that's how I thought of it. And we went down to this hole in the ground.
How deep is it?
I'm not sure, but I think it's meant to be able to take a sort of direct hit by a nuclear weapon.
What size of nuclear weapon is that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Because the hole in the ground at Mons, the Sacheur's hole in the ground, was originally designed to be nuclear proof, but the budget for constructing it was cut, and that meant that, they spent an enormous amount of resources concreting it, but it wasn't deep enough to be proof against.
Sure. I don't know. I mean, I doubt it was it was proof against a thermonuclear weapon, but and again, it was probably built about the same time as the hole in the ground at Mons, but I don't know. I wasn't actually all that worried about that.
Well,
I wasn't.
Is it possible that it is actually a decoy?
I don't know, Nigel. I mean, it may well be. That wasn't something that was going through my head at the time.
Right. Okay, so you went, you went to the hole in the ground.
I went to the hole in the ground with Mike, and we went, and we had announced that we were coming.
Yes.
And they sort of expressed some surprise. You know, why do you want to go? They said we'd like to find out what the hell's going on, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
So we went there, and the first chap we met was the CNC himself, John Fieldhouse, who said to her, he's quite a jovial character, he said, nice to see you, and all that sort of thing, and then said, I have told the politicians that this is going to be a bloody business, which actually rather cheered us up. You'd think that might not, but it did slightly cheer us up, because there was a sort of air of unreality, I thought, in some political circles. I mean, we heard Roy Hattersley on the radio referring to the Argentine leadership as sort of tin pot dictators, and I thought, you know, that is the last thing I want to get in the heads of my blokes, that these guys are going to be a pushover. So the quicker the politicians are put in the picture by the military, the better. And so I was rather heartened by that thought. We then went into a sort of meeting which was going on, which was presided over by the chief of staff of this headquarters, who was Vice Admiral, I can't remember his name, come back to me in a minute, he was a Vice Admiral, and a whole lot of other guys, and we were slightly astounded to be asked what ideas we had for the amphibious operation, and what sort of options could we provide, what do we think was the way to play it, which was the first thing we'd heard of. We thought we were going to be told what we were required to do. And so we gave an impromptu sort of what I would call, you know, idiot's guide to amphibious operations in about 10 minutes.
What you could do and what you couldn't
do. What we could do and what we could do.
In broad terms.
In broad terms, looking with, you know, based on a small sort of almost Child's Atlas-sized map of the Falklands, which was pinned on the wall. We did a number of things at that meeting. We said to them, and they agreed, that an amphibious operation was not possible without air superiority. You know, that such a thing was a bad notion, as we'd learned to our cost in places like Norway and Crete in the Second World War. And they agreed heartily with that.
Was there an RAF officer present at this briefing?
Not that I remember. There was an RAF officer on the staff. There was an air marshal.
So there was no immediate air liaison in your meeting?
Not that I remember. They may have been, but I don't remember one.
Presumably you didn't have an RAF officer attached to your brigade headquarters?
No, I had a Fleet Air on fighter pilot on my brigade headquarters, brigade aviation officer, who provided me with, you know, fixed-wing advice.
Right.
the meeting was actually pretty inconclusive.
Yeah. Did they have any ideas of their own about what they thought might be desirable? Did they show any signs of particular appreciation when you mentioned one idea rather than another?
No. I think they were under so much pressure. They were literally, I got the impression, they were like men in shock, I thought. There was one other chap there, which Mike and I were rather glad to see. He was a chap called Admiral Reffel, Rear Admiral Reffel, whose normal task was to command all the carriers, all the amphibious ships. And he had been the captain of Albion when she'd been in LPH, and he'd also done Mike's job, one job before, so he knew all about amphibious operations. And on his staff, he had a few amphibious experts and aviation experts. And we thought, hooray, this guy is going to be the overall naval commander. You know, we jump to this conclusion. That's what he's there for. That's why he's there. He'd be the logical chap to do it. As it turned out, he wasn't. The naval carrier battle group commander was Sandy Woodward, who who had already been warned for the job and who knew absolutely nothing about amphibious operations at all, was a submariner and didn't know much about aviation either. And so we were disappointed when we learned that Derek Reffel, who was the name of this other admiral, was not to come and be the naval senior commander.
Now, why was that? Was it simply a matter of seniority or some other?
The slightest idea, Nigel. I mean, it was completely bonkers, in my opinion. Because what they then did is they stripped his staff to give Sandy Woodward the necessary amphibious and not that it was all that good expertise and aviation expertise. And I don't know why it was done. I mean, it was because John Fieldhouse had decided that Sandy Woodward was to do it, presumably because he was closer, because he was in Gibraltar doing an exercise. And therefore he could, you know, get there quicker. But, I mean, Derek could have been flown down there. It was to my mind, it was an absolutely lunatic decision. And from it, a whole thing, a stack of things flowed, like the command structure, which I can talk about, which was completely bizarre. Why he wasn't used, I have no idea. I don't know. To this day, I don't. Mike and I often talk about it. I haven't the slightest idea. Because John Fieldhouse is dead, unfortunately, because otherwise we'd be asking him. And so is the Chief of Staff, dead. So I don't know why. You know, there's no one around that I know of. In fact, and also the Chief of Operations, a captain called Fox, is dead. So there's no way of asking anyone in any sort of senior position why the hell they didn't send Reffel down.
Well, Sandy Woodward himself, in his own memoir, says he's got, you know, he hasn't the foggiest idea of why he was chosen for them.
No, I mean, I always think it's because that he and Fieldhouse were submariners. And Sandy tells me that wasn't the case because he and Fieldhouse didn't actually get on all that well.
Yes.
So it wasn't a sort of, you know, a sort of old chum's net.
No, he was. I mean, he was as surprised as you were. I think, judging by what
absolutely
what he's written about it.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. So anyway, we, having done that, we then leapt back in our helicopter and flew back to Plymouth, and not wildly impressed at the thought of going to war under this headquarters, I might say.
Had they given you any sort of information about the situation in the islands?
No.
Or about any idea about what the politicians wanted or?
No.
No.
Had no idea. None idea. We got nothing out of them at all.
Mm.
Nothing. At all. The next day, we flew to Bryce Norton. This is now the fifth. The reason we flew to Bryce Norton was because the Royal Marine Detachment, which had been captured in the Falklands, was being flown back via Montevideo and was going to arrive in Bryce Norton that afternoon. And it struck us that it might be quite useful to talk to them, find out you know, what had happened. In fact, actually, it was a complete waste of time, of course, in retrospect. The people we were going to be up against were not the same people they were up against, so we didn't know that at the time.
But they might have had something to say about Argentinian attitudes and
yes.
style, and also
yes.
the reaction of the civilian population, which
yeah.
can be material, can't it?
Yeah, sure. So it wasn't totally wasted, mm-hmm. but it was again a slightly opera move, because there was a minister whose name I can't remember from the Minister of Defence who met them, he. Was going to take them to have tea with the Prime Minister. And the one thing that was worrying him, was uppermost in his mind, that was they might be late for tea, and that he'd get his wrist slapped by Margaret Thatcher. It was clearly a prospect that terrified him. And that was actually much more important to him than allowing us any time to interrogate these guys who just got back. So in the middle of all the interrogation, he kept on saying, come on, we've got to get going, you know. And the most useful interrogator, actually, was Ewan South Petalia, who I brought with me, because he knew the questions to ask about conditions in the island at the time, and were certain characters there. The reason that was important was we're coming into the southern hemisphere winter, when some of the wealthier islanders used to push off to warmer parts for holidays, and therefore it was important to know who was there still.
They would be the weather gauge.
Well, they would be to a degree, but they were also, some of them were quite important because they were key people who were very anti-Argentine, who might form, you know, a folk.